Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Hello, and welcome to New Horror Express, your now weekly podcast chatting to the best in the talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's episode, I'm chatting to writer-director Nicholas Santos about his debut feature, the slasher horror comedy, It Cuts Deep. Over the course of the interview, Nicholas talks about the difficulty of finding the film's tonal balance, what 80s slashers inspired him on this movie, and how surprisingly smooth the shoot was for the film. Plus, we talk about whether he was worried that the unlikable nature of some of the film's principal characters would turn off audience members, and we get into how Nicholas set out to skewer toxic masculinity in the movie. Away from the film, we get into our favourite Friday the 13th films, and Nicholas's love of Christmas and Christmas horror, but not surprisingly, Silent Night, Deadly Night. There you go. All of which you can hear right now in our interview with Nicholas. Hi, Nicholas. Welcome to New Horror Express.
Thanks for having me.
So we've got you on the show today to talk about your debut feature, It Cuts Deep. So for the listeners at home, can you give us a brief spoiler-free synopsis of It Cuts Deep?
Yep. So It Cuts Deep is a horror comedy about my fear of getting married and having children. It's about a young couple that go on Christmas vacation. And the boyfriend finds out for the first time that the girlfriend is very serious about getting married and having children, which freaks him out. And then when old friend of his shows up who's much more handsome and paternal than he is, things kind of just spiral out of control.
And apart from your own fears, where how did you initially come up with the idea?
So yeah, actually the idea initially came when I was actually preparing to propose to my then girlfriend, and I kind of got this very deep fear of commitment that hit me that I was like, this is perfect to turn into a horror film. I am happily married now, but it seemed like the perfect kind of inspiration to kick off the story.
And how long did it take you to kind of develop the script and see where the story, fill out the story?
It was a pretty fast process, actually. Everything about it kind of worked out pretty well. It was about, took me from outline to the first draft, it took me 2 to 3 months. And then we just revised, like, I don't know, maybe 50 to 60 drafts after that over a course of a year. But really the bones and like the meat of it were there after a couple months.
And did it change a lot from the first draft through those many, many drafts? Or was the kind of setup really there pretty solid from early on?
The setup and structure was definitely there. The biggest changes are really just kind of like fine-tuning the tone, especially as a horror comedy. It's like it was hard to find the perfect balance of comedy and horror, and that was really just like the toughest part about it. And actually, at first they were actually supposed to be going on summer vacation, and we were going to shoot it in August. And then due to some complications, we ended up pushing it back 6 months. So then at that point, I actually rewrote it as a Christmas movie, which I think it wanted to be the whole time anyways. So it worked out great.
I was interested by the kind of Christmas thing. I see that you had another short film that you did called Holiday Fear that's Christmas based as well. Is this a kind of theme that you're planning to build a la Shane Black?
I think I just love Christmas, to be honest. But yeah, with my short Holiday Fear was a Christmas horror comedy as well. Honestly, it kind of just made sense to, it had a very, the short, it like thematically wasn't very similar, but tonally with the horror comedy, it was very similar. So it kind of made sense that It Cuts Deep kind of ended up being an extension of the short. And yeah, I just really love Christmas, and the Christmas imagery just worked out so well.
And yeah, so early on, like, what kind of film was it, and how much did it change in terms of that tone then? Was it more comedic originally, or more horror originally, and did one become more predominant later on?
Yeah, I think it was a little bit lighter at first. And actually the first draft didn't have kind of the big twist at the end. It had like a version of it, but it wasn't as like clear. So the twist actually happened somewhere in one of the first revisions. So yeah, it was definitely lighter, a little bit more comedic, and then I kind of fine-tuned that. I think one of the biggest inspirations on it, in high school, I was very obsessed with Shaun of the Dead. I think I watched it hundreds of times. And I love about that movie, I love the tone of, I love the balance of horror comedy in that movie especially. And with this, I also wanted to like Shaun of the Dead, where it kind of is like a rom-com in a way, if you pull out the genre elements. So I wanted this film to also kind of feel like that. If you actually pulled out the slasher elements, you'd still have this like a nice like bones and structure to the human story of it.
And you talk about the kind of slasher element there, like, again, don't want to give any spoilers, but in the kind of opening scene, there's a kind of very slasher kind of opening scene, and it made me think of a lot of things, just because like it was like set at Christmas, you know, Silent Night, yeah. Deadly Night. That was because of the way the killer is dressed, that looked kind of Halloween, and the machete, you know, was very much kind of Jason. Was that all very much deliberate? You were packing in those references, or it's just kind of like, this is a slasher thing?
Yeah, it's kind of like, I kind of wanted to grab bits and pieces from all my favorite slashers and kind of combine them into one thing. And especially the way that sequence is shot is very much Friday the 13th. I especially love kind of the earlier Friday the 13th, especially the first like 15 minutes of the second one. I just love the way that they shoot the kills in that without revealing Jason. So I kind of wanted to take that style and see if I could do it. Especially with, since it's like a flashback to a murder, it felt right to kind of have it feel a little bit more nostalgic in a way.
Yeah, because it does have quite a kind of 80s kind of feel. And like that scene kind of initially does make it seem like it's going to be slightly lighter in tone. I did like the kind of joke about like the two teens talking and the guy doesn't understand euphemisms.
Yeah, I really wanted to, I think the most important thing I thought about that scene was I wanted to immediately establish the tone. So I wanted to immediately establish that the movie's not taking itself too seriously and that it is funny, but then also immediately follow that up with like a brutal murder. So I think that first 2 minutes like really kind of just sets you up for what you're in store for.
And I was going to ask, in terms of like, once the script was done, how quickly did it then you get it into production and start shooting?
It was a pretty long process, actually. I guess it'd be like a year and a half that it took me to finally get it made. We had some interest in some like possible bigger funding initially. But I kind of had always written it to just go shoot on my own if I had to. So when the other funding fell through, I basically had to spend an extra 6 months kind of wrangling and scraping together the small budget that we did shoot it on.
And how did you come across your kind of central cast, like the central three characters played by Charles Gould, Quinn Jackson, and John Anderson?
Yeah, so Charles... I originally, one of my more recent shorts, Charles had auditioned for. And so Charles is a great, hilarious stand-up comedian. And I had known him through, I went to college with these two comedians. One of them is Joe Pera, who has a show on Adult Swim. So I was friends with him, and they used to have a live comedy show every week. So I knew Charles through that. And I kind of had always wanted to put him in a movie. It didn't work out for the short, but then when I wrote this, they just seemed like perfect casting. So I initially just offered it to him. And then when we were looking to go cast for Nolan, Charles was like, I know the perfect guy. He used to be in 30 Rock. He's super funny, but also like can be really creepy and strange as well. And so John Anderson came in for the audition and just nailed it. And it was kind of weird because like, in a way, I'm always like, oh, we should audition more people to see more people. But John just nailed it. He was the first person we saw, and he just was clearly the character.
So did you actually see anybody after that? Or did you just decide on the day that you're our Nolan?
Yeah, the next day I was just like, you have it. You have the role if you want it. And it was really good because him and Charles have a history together. Like, they've been friends for a while. So it really actually worked out for their friendship. Since they actually have known each other for a while. And they also love trying to one-up each other. So on set, it's always, all those scenes where they're kind of going head-to-head is very funny because they, in person, they're actually trying to one-up each other and try to, they're all constantly in competition to see who they, like, who could get the crew to laugh the hardest, which I think worked out. And then originally, the role of Ashley was supposed to be played by the actress from my short Holiday Fear. And then she had to drop out due to another conflict with another project. And then, like, I'd say like 2 months before we were supposed to shoot, we kind of had to scramble and do a ton of auditions. We saw a ton of people. And luckily we came across Quinn, who just really knocked it out of the park.
And what made you think that, oh, Quinn is definitely going to be our Ashley?
She had to have two things, basically. She had to be able to kind of go head to head with Charles and John and play the straight man and kind of keep up with them. And then at the same time, she had to be able to really go to crazy emotional levels. And so when we did the auditions, it was just trying to do a mixture of comedy and then a mixture and then mix in there like very huge emotions, crying, screaming, and just like, I guess all the Scream Queen stuff that she had to do as an actress.
And how was the shoot of the movie? Was it a smooth shoot, or was there any kind of notable on-set disasters?
It was actually a very smooth shoot, surprisingly, because since we were on a very tight budget, and because of that we were on an extremely tight schedule, that if anything had gone very wrong, then we could have been kind of screwed. But so we shot for 12 days in February. The hardest part was just the fact that it was just so cold the entire shoot, even though it never really snowed, but it was just constantly freezing. And so when we were shooting the climax scenes, those were probably the most difficult days because we'd be shooting until midnight or 1, just in like 10 degree weather and just doing such like intense scenes and intense doing practical effects. It was a lot, but nothing ever went seriously wrong. And we actually, on the last day of shooting, we actually wrapped 4 hours early and then used that time to instead like finish packing up. And we just had so much extra time actually that we just threw a giant party at the end, which was
wow. That's impressive that you wrapped 4 hours early. I've just interviewed so many indie filmmakers there that it just always seems like a mad panic. It seems quite unusual.
It's funny. Charles talks about a thing where he was constantly joking because I would always be like, oh, we have 2 days set to do extra shooting if we have to. And he was always convinced that it was going to go 2 more days, and then we just never had to do any reshoots, and it was great. It was a very, I try to keep the vibe on set as open as possible, as positive, and, I try to keep it so everyone can kind of chime in with an idea if someone gets a good idea. And one of the very fun things that this is the first movie I did it on, but every night we would have a movie night with the crew at the crew house. And I would put on a different movie that were in some way, even if it was like obscurely inspired the film, which is good because some of the non-horror crew has like never seen some of the Friday the 13th movies. And yeah, It was just a super fun way to get everyone bonding and having a good time.
So maybe people knew kind of what kind of vibe you were drawing from. What was some of those movies? Was it largely just a selection of slashers then?
Yeah, I think the Friday the 13th I put on was the final chapter, which people kind of lost it too, because there's a lot of, I feel like there's a lot of funny moments in that one. And then The Shining was a big one. I think Alien, trying to look over at my Blu-ray collection to see which ones I brought. even like Shane Black's The Nice Guys was another one I put on because I just love the tone of that movie. So it was a mixture of horror and also some comedies thrown in there.
All right, cool. And I also, as previously mentioned, to share the Shane Black's love of Christmas.
Yeah. huge Shane Black fan.
That's a good choice with the final chapter as well. My second favorite Friday the 13th movie.
What's your favorite?
Friday the 13th Part 6, Jason Lives.
Oh, that's great. I think it's probably the most controversial one, because everyone says, because it's at the top of everyone's list, but then some people throw it way down the bottom of their list because of the tone, I guess.
Oh yeah, because of the, like, maybe, yeah, because it's like comedic and yeah. It's all kind of, it's got the kind of meta stuff in that. I really like that about it. I think it's, there's just certain scenes in that movie, like the opening scene is one of my favorite scenes in a Friday the 13th movie, where he comes back from the dead after, like,
it's so good.
Yeah, like the rod gets struck by lightning. And then he, like, the camera pans into the eye hole in the hockey mask, and he walks across the screen like James Bond, and then he slashes the screen, and the blood runs down the screen. It's amazing. I also recently did an episode of the podcast, and I have like a kind of bonus monthly series where I look at kind of guilty pleasure movies. And the last one that I did with a couple of former guests was Jason X, which I would say there's probably one of the most controversial Friday, you know, like Jason movies, because a lot of people, I think it's really fun and I would put it near the top of my list, but a lot of people absolutely hate that movie and hate Uber Jason and put it right at the bottom.
I used to hate it. And then I revisited it not that long ago. I was like, oh, this is actually isn't as bad as I remembered. So I've grown to like it more than I used to.
Yeah. It's an entertaining movie. So it sounds like in terms of the shoot, it sounds like it was a pretty smooth shoot. So it doesn't sound like it felt like a massive jump to you from going from short films to a feature film. You know, because there's some directors I've talked to before that are, you know, it's their debut feature and it's like it seemed like a big jump up, but it obviously doesn't seem to have been that way for yourself.
What was nice about it is that I don't think I could have done it as, I don't think it would have been as smooth if I hadn't been working with my DP, Kyle Kelly, who I've worked with for, like, we've been working together for the past 10 years and are able to just kind of move very quickly, and because we kind of both just know what, like, we just share what we want, and sometimes don't even have to talk. We, like, with just looks and gestures, can we just know what we're gonna do next? Which sometimes stress out the AD who doesn't understand when we're moving so fast. But yeah, really, it was just the crew was so great. So really, just putting together a great crew and great cast led to us having the most small amount of issues that could come up. And I've also been on other feature shoots. I produced another micro-budget feature before this. So through that, I also kind of learned the biggest things to try to avoid.
Oh, okay. We can... Shall we talk a bit about that? Because I realize that you're, as the micro-budget film, you're referring to Uncle Peckerhead.
Oh, yeah. Uncle Becker, which came out in August, which was another fun shoot. It was a little bit of a crazier shoot.
Yes, it certainly sounds like it. I've This is going to be confusing for the audience, but from our vantage point, my episodes, the interviewing the director of Uncle Peckerhead, Matthew James Lawrence, comes out in like a week's time, just over a week's time. But from the perspective of the listener listening to this, it has come out roughly a month ago.
Great. Yeah, Matt's great. I've been working with Matt for a while. I worked on his, I was assistant camera on his first feature like 10 years ago. And then we kind of just became friends. And then I produced a short horror comedy called Larry Gone Demon for him that did the festival rounds in 2015. And then I was there from the first day helping him develop Uncle Peckerhead, which sounds like everyone will find out more with Matt's episode.
Indeed. That sounds like it was quite stressful, which again, if you're listening to this, you might have listened to already, so you might already know that.
And it just weirdly worked out with the timing that both our movies just ended up being kind of released almost back to back. Because we shot them, they were shot 6 months apart, but then now they're being released 3 months apart.
Yeah, and we'll go back to your feature in a second, but how did you get into producing as well? You've got your own production company. How did you get into that side of things?
So I kind of always, ever since I've been making stuff, I just like have been always wearing a lot of hats and always just producing my own stuff. And then I realized I could kind of take that skill set and then help other filmmakers make their own stuff. It's nice to like help someone else realize their vision and just use the skill set I had learned from my own work. And it kind of just came naturally to do both. And even with It Cuts Deep, I was heavily involved with the producing. I had a great producing partner in Christy Richmond, and just together, yeah, we kind of just handled all of it.
Is the 88-90 thing, like, is your producing partner, were they born in 1990? I noticed they were born in 1988, so I was like,
yes,
well, that exactly. Might be where that comes from.
Yeah, she was born in 1990, so...
Okay. Makes sense.
I was trying to look up, we were trying to figure out a company name, and there was something about 88 and 90 that felt kind of vague, but also interesting, and like a little, there was something nostalgic about doing 88 and 90, but yeah, that's how that came about.
And how kind of hands-on are you as a producer?
Very hands-on. Very always on set. Kind of always in the trenches is the type of producer I am. Yeah, and just kind of there on the front lines going to war with the rest of the crew. I never want to ask the crew to do anything that I wouldn't do myself.
Okay, cool.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely makes sense. I know that some producers have a more kind of hands-off approach, but I did interview a guy called Travis Stevens, and he's the opposite. He's like yourself, very hands-on there. In the trenches, yeah. With the people.
And he was also very, he was heavily involved with Dark Sky Films, who will be releasing It Cuts Deep.
And let's talk a little bit about that then, and then we can kind of skip back to the film and the plot. In terms of like Dark Sky Films picking it up, they picked it up at the virtual Cannes market, is that correct? And how did that come about, and how excited were you about that it got picked up?
So how Dark Sky became involved, actually. So initially, we were supposed to have our world premiere at Boston Underground in March, and then COVID hit, and that just got canceled. And then I was kind of just sitting there realizing that we could possibly not have a festival run or not play anywhere until 2021. So then I kind of started aggressively reaching out to as many distributors and sales agents as I could. And I kind of just cold emailed Dark Sky Films and talked to Greg Newman there and Giles Edwards, and it just clicked with them, and they just loved the movie, and it felt just like the perfect fit. They were kind of always actually on the top of my list, and I was kind of afraid to reach out to them for a while, and then eventually I just, yeah, it's a fuck it, I'll just email them and see what happens. And then it worked out.
So you must have been pretty excited, given that they were top of your list, to secure that release.
Yeah, from them. I mean, as you know, they have such a good history of films and just seemed like very supportive of filmmakers, which has definitely been the case.
And talking about your festival run as well, obviously COVID hit in March, like you said, and everything went to shit. But how excited were you that when it was digital festivals started making appearances and you're actually going to get something of a festival run towards the end of this year?
Yeah, I think I can't remember what month it was in, but then I like Chattanooga happened, so then I got the pass to Chattanooga and I was like, oh, I'll see how a virtual festival actually is. And that was so great, and I was like, oh, this is actually, this like can work and can be good. And then from there I kind of worked with Dark Sky to figure out where we're going to premiere and where we're going to kind of start it back up again. And then it kind of all somehow came back around, because then Boston Underground, although they were canceled, they then partnered up with Overlook, Brooklyn Horror, Popcorn Frights, and North Bend to make Nightstream. So in a way, we are still actually premiering through Boston Underground, but just at the mega Nightstream Festival now, which I'm super excited about.
And you've got a couple other festivals on the way, including the UK premiere be at Grimfest again. I'm advertising that and it's already happened, but
very excited to play Grimfest is always very high on my list, so I'm glad that worked out, and they've been great to work with, and hopefully that will lead to a UK release very soon.
Have you played anything there before? Has any of your shorts or anything got in there before? Or is this your first Grimfest?
It'll be my first Grimfest, yeah. I don't know. I think I just like think that maybe the timing doesn't work out before the shorts. But super excited to play it this year.
And I understand that you're doing, have done a Q&A at the festival.
Yeah, so I'll be doing a Q&A at Grimfest, which will be live over Zoom with the full cast. Should be nice.
Excellent. Well, I've got a pass for Grimfest, so I'm looking forward to that. So to go back to talking about the film, so the characters in the film, they're not the most likable bunch. Were you at all worried about putting anybody off? Likeability factor?
Not really. I mean, that was actually some of the biggest notes that we got on the script, but especially with Sam. But there was something about Sam that just needed to be unlikable, I guess, in a way. Especially since he eventually becomes the antagonist of the movie. And really, just kind of my sense of humor. And I wasn't ever really afraid to putting people off. I know it actually does put some people off, but I just love the character so much. And although sometimes sometimes Sam and Nolan can both be annoying, but Charles and John play them with such so much heart that I don't know. It always, they're never making fun. The script and their performance are never making fun of the characters. They're always true to the character, even if the character is sometimes unlikable.
So you were never afraid to kind of, you didn't pull any of your punches at all?
No, not at all. Actually, we had a great, me and Charles had a great way of working together where we kind of get the scene as written. And once I knew we had it as written, I would then let Charles kind of go off the rails and go kind of crazy and do a lot of ad-libbing, a lot of improv. And then I'd grab little bits and pieces here and there from his improv and then kind of rework the improv back into what the actual lines are. And we'd kind of, sometimes we'd go way too crazy and I'd get to the editing room and I was like, this doesn't work. But a lot of times, a lot of the takes I used were us really kind of pushing it as far as we possibly could, which was super fun. And they're actually, if you buy the Blu-ray, there's a 10-minute outtake video that's very funny. And you can see some of the other crazy things that, some of the other crazy versions of the scenes that we did.
I actually, that was one of the things I was going to ask about, like, you know, because Charles stand up and like John's obviously a comic actor as well, if there had been much in the way of improvisation on set.
Sometimes I was just letting Charles and John go off and seeing what happened. And then, yeah, like I said, trying to like work that improv back into the actual scenes. Because me and Charles share a very similar kind of cringeworthy sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
So it was also fun to kind of push that as far as possible.
I was also on the character of Sam. Like, I was a bit reminded of, I don't know if you've seen it, but there is a movie called Harpoon that's directed by somebody who's been on the show, Rob Grant. Have you seen that film?
Yeah, I liked it a lot.
Okay. So the character Nat, played by Monroe, the one played by Monroe Chambers, it reminded me a little bit of that character. And I wanted to ask you, the character of Sam kind of becomes more unlikable, so that, like, it just becomes unlikable. But initially, there's a kind of nerdiness to him, and a kind of, like, I feel like I would have responded to him and been more related to him and found him more likable maybe like 15 years ago if I was like 20, you know. But now, like I see that character and I'm like, I'm kind of, oh, maybe I can see part of myself. But now, like, I saw that character, much like what I said to Rob as well, and I'm like, oh, that guy could be a fan of Ben Shapiro.
What
I mean?
It's like there's something I love kind of making fun of, is like that toxic masculinity and that kind of, I mean, it's very much there in Sam with like the dick jokes that he is constantly trying to tell, where it's much more a teen attitude towards things that you would find relatable 10 years ago, but now you can kind of see past it. That's a great comparison though, now that I think of it.
And I suppose because like it's more like, because you're more aware of that sort of thing as well, of like these people on the internet and like incel culture and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I definitely wanted to push that, especially when like Sam and Nolan are kind of going head to head and Ashley is just like, what the fuck is happening? Why, like, can you guys both just stop, please?
I like the way you played with it, particularly in that scene and particularly at the end of that scene when like Sam just can't see what he's done wrong at all, and he's just like, how can you know, like, I'm the good guy, he's the bad guy, like I'm the good guy, like what?
I think that's one of my favorite parts of the movie, is when he does that quick little rant at the end when she goes back up inside, kind of, because it's kind of in the halfway point of the movie too. And then it's just like a big sense of irony there. And I had written it like that, and then I remember Charles was kind of trying to play it kind of straighter, and then I was like, no, you just have to say those lines like as fast as possible and as loud as possible. And then the way he just captures it in that moment, where he just is entirely just so blind to how terrible he is being, and how much of a dick he is actually being.
It seems like just kind of going back to your short film, Holiday Fear, as well, it seems like a kind of area, a topic that you're interested in, the kind of perceptions of masculinity, toxic masculinity.
Yeah, it's definitely a reoccurring theme in my work, especially with these two movies. I guess it's just kind of like the attitude I kind of grew up in Massachusetts. That was constant. That was definitely, and especially I guess at the time of like late 90s, early 2000s, where I feel like it was even more prevalent, not as much just on the internet as it is now, but so I think because of kind of growing up in a culture like that, it just is embedded in my work now.
I mean, I similarly find it kind of interesting as a topic, and I wonder if it's kind of being roughly our age. I mean, you're you're 32. I've just turned 35. So like, you know that, and like, yeah, there was a lot of that. It did seem like there was a lot of that kind of knuckle dragging machismo in the late 90s, early 2000s, very kind of in your face masculinity that was seen as perfectly fine. And 20 years later is kind of in retrospect, not so good.
Yeah. I mean, you still see it in so many people, and I just think it's something that is, now I just look back at it and I just, or when I see it today, I just think it's funny and fun to make fun of in a way.
Yes. I think it's, I think it's good to make fun of as well. Although, sorry to any fans of the show who are also fans of Ben Shapiro or Gav McInnes or Milo Yiannopoulos or whatever bullshit figure that has become popular on the internet recently.
Yeah.
Anyway, moving on from that rant. I was going to ask as well about, you know, obviously it's an interesting blend of genres. Were you at all worried about that it would prove kind of confusing, that it would start as, it would open as a slasher and then there was a kind of romantic comedy, and do you kind of have to piece together, oh, how do these connect?
I was a little worried about it. That was something the thing that was always on the back of my mind while we were shooting was trying to control the tone, because I knew it would be tricky, and it was really just, working really closely with John and Charles to kind of figure out that tone, because Quinn in a way is just plays the straight man throughout the movie, and it's kind of the audience's vessel to kind of experience the movie, seeing how John and Charles are going to such extreme lengths on both sides. It was important too to we'd do scenes sometimes more dramatically and then we'd do them sometimes more comedically. So I was always trying to make sure too that we had the options in the editing room in case something wasn't funny or wasn't playing well, or if the pacing of the, sometimes the pacing would be off because of the tone shifts. So it was always good that for most scenes, I always kind of had a backup, more serious take that could work.
And but did you, when you were kind of shooting the film, did you lean more comedic, or from the script, you know, just the kind of the John and Charles and having that kind of comic background?
I've known from experience, like with some of my shorts, I knew it was always better to kind of cast, like, if it's going to be funny, we should always cast for comedians, and I feel like comedians have a better time at being more serious and acting, being more dramatic in their acting than a dramatic actor trying to be funny, if that is
that makes sense. For sure.
With the script, I don't know. I have a hard time writing a 100% serious script. So for me, I'm always trying to make it fun for myself. And it's very satisfying to see someone read the script and then laugh while they're reading it. I love getting a reaction from the audience, whether that is a shock or a laugh. So,
and I was wondering as well, in terms of, is the slasher movie kind of your favorite subgenre of horror?
Yeah, I guess I would say it is. It's the one I always come back to for sure. And it sounds like a little stereotypical, but my favorite movie is The Shining, even if that's not 100%, like, it kind of falls in the slasher, I guess, but that's a movie I always come back to every single
year.
That's
an interesting take. Yeah. I never thought
because
I always think of it as more of a kind of supernatural horror. It's not quite a haunted house movie, but, you know, it's a haunted hotel. But yeah, I suppose it's kind of a slasher as well.
Because of the Yeah, I don't know. I've never heard of anyone actually referring to it that way, but because of the cat and mouse element of it, with the stalking and the cat and mouse element, it always felt kind of slashery to me, even though obviously there's not a high kill count or anything like that. But yeah, I've always been obsessed with The Shining and the first two Halloween movies and Friday the 13th, and then some of the more obscure ones. It's funny because I am not a fan of Silent Night, Deadly Night, which I feel like is a little surprising seeing how I made a Christmas slasher. But
yeah, that is surprising. It's like the lead, it's the lead Christmas slasher right there. I mean, there is others are available. Christmas Evil, for example.
I do like Black Christmas.
So. You do like Black Christmas, is a classic, yeah.
And a lot of people hated on that new Blumhouse version of it, and I thought it was fine.
I've still not seen that. I've seen the other remake, which isn't good.
Yeah, I don't think I saw that other remake.
You can skip the 06 one. Yeah, no, a lot of people, a lot of people shot on last year's Black Christmas, but I've not seen it, so I'm not going to comment. I'll hold.
I mean, I see what people are complaining about how it's like, but I don't know. Let them make slashers for a teen audience is what I say.
Yeah, for sure. I was just to go back to the Shining. Like, The Shining is also my favorite movie, and I, again, like you, I kind of sometimes hesitate to say it because like it feels like a boring choice, but it is definitely my favorite movie. And do people as quickly, you know, tell you that it's not a good adaptation of the novel, and also highlight that Stephen King hates it? Because like people, that seems to be the kind of automatic response, is the kind of like you probably didn't know and you probably weren't aware, and I'm just going to tell you these facts. I'm going to hit you up with these facts that you've definitely not heard 1,000 times.
Yeah. I mean, I've read the book multiple times. I've seen the movie hundreds of times. The movie, I'll come out with a hot take and say the movie is much better than the book. But the book does work in certain ways. I mean, they're two different entire mediums, so I don't know. There's a reason why Mike Flanagan referenced the movie more in Doctor Sleep.
So was that, in terms of like movies you saw when you were younger that kind of inspired you to become a filmmaker, would you say that was one of them?
Yeah, that pretty much all of Kubrick's movies were heavily up there. I was also obsessed with Full Metal Jacket, Barry Lyndon, Clockwork Orange, and for me, my love of horror kind of goes back to when I was a little kid. One of my first big horror movie memories, my dad took me to see Event Horizon when I was like in second grade, and it blew me away. He saw some behind the scenes thing on HBO, and he was like, oh, and he like loved Lawrence Fishburne, so he was like, let's go see this movie in the theaters. And I don't think he realized how crazy and fucked up the movie was.
I'm trying to think of when Event Horizon came out. So you'd be like, what, like 9 when that came out? Because I'm just thinking, I'm probably
I think like, I was, I think I was 7. Yeah, probably not the right age to be watching that movie, but absolutely loved it. And then, so my dad actually played a key role because he also, around that same time, made me watch Psycho and The Birds. And those movies just blew me away at the time. And then basically one of my best friends, who was actually the best man at my wedding, every weekend we'd basically make his mom bring us the Blockbuster, and then we'd rent 3 movies from the horror shelf. And we'd just do that every weekend for like 5 years, and just made our way through as many horror movies as we possibly could.
Nice. And can you remember any kind of particular favorites that kind of popped out during that phase, renting horror movies all the time?
It was, I mean, one of the biggest nights I think was when we rented Evil Dead, Evil Dead 2, and Army of Darkness, and just watching those movies for the first time, I just made such a big impact on us.
I remember I think there's definitely something to that as well. I did presume you still were renting on VHS at the time.
Yeah, definitely.
I remember having like Evil Dead on like VHS, watched it a bunch of times, became grainier in it, obviously, and it's like, I don't know, I almost hesitate to get like the Blu-ray of it, because I just like the graininess of a VHS seems to just suit the Evil Dead, particularly the first one.
I was actually saying this exact thing, because when we premiered Uncle Peckerhead at Panic Fest, right before COVID hit, which was great, so we had like a actual festival experience with Uncle Peckerhead right before. But at that, they had a special screening of the 4K restoration of it, and while it looked great and it was interesting to see a 4K restoration, the first thing I said when I walked out was, it should be watched on VHS and not 4K in a movie theater. There's something about the graininess and like the, yeah, it just really, that definitely captures that movie. And I don't think it should ever be in 4K, but to each his own, I guess.
Nah, I suppose so. But yeah, I think there's definitely something, and there's some of the like, there's certain movies, particularly certain kind of early 80s kind of movies that have a kind of certain sleaze factor to them that should just be watched on a VHS. Something like Maniac shouldn't be watched in like Blu-ray or whatever, you know, like it should be watched in kind of the grainiest VHS you can find.
Yeah, 100%. It's something that adds like a feeling too of like, should you be watching this movie right now? Actually, to my wife's dismay, I saw a VCR that was on the street the other day that said, I still work, and I had to bring it home. And now, I guess
that's awesome.
VHS tapes again. But yeah, I was like, I just have to bring it. And then I think I only have a couple of VHS tapes right now, but there's something nice about it, even though it looks kind of weird next to my PS4. But
I can imagine. So, In terms of going forward, are you just kind of following It Cuts Deep in this kind of festival tour and then for release, or are you currently working on any projects at the moment?
I have multiple projects I'm trying to get off the ground right now. They kind of vary in style and tone. One of them, I have a home invasion horror film that's called The Bad Friend that I have finished that I'm shopping around. And then I have another horror comedy called You Kill Me that's more in tone with It Cuts Deep and kind of feels more like a sister movie to it. That's about a husband that sees his wife kill a man in self-defense, and kind of their relationship kind of starts to unravel as he becomes terrified of her and thinks that maybe she may kill him next. And then I got another new genre project that I just started that I'm only through the first act, but very excited about.
So the other two projects, have you got scripts set for them?
Yeah, so those two, I have drafts right now for both of those that are done that I feel very strong about and are kind of in talks with some people. We'll see. One of them has a stronger lead right now, so possibly over the next few months. Hoping to get the go-ahead, but we'll see. Also, we'll see when productions could even start up again. Because unless you have unless you're Disney right now, it seems kind of hard to get something up and running.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, Disney, but then I mean, Disney has all the money. Keep buying up film studios, and
it's kind of scary actually. Especially with all the news of them being kind of restricting access to the Fox library.
The stuff that came out about like the kind of repertory screenings and stuff like that of like Fox titles, and the way they're kind of, it looks like they're maybe corralling them to the same sort of thing that they do with the Disney catalog, where they only push it out for certain anniversaries that they decide.
I think one of the urges for me to grab the VCR was my constant dread about everything becoming streaming and then losing access to stuff. There's something like a little scary about that, which is why it's nice to still support the, when I love a new movie, I love to just then support it by buying it on Blu-ray and try to keep the Blu-ray business alive.
I like to do that as well. I like my DVD shelf and all that, and support movies, people.
There's something reassuring about having physical media on your shelf, and if your internet goes out and want to watch a movie, you still can.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's a nice note to kind of wrap up on, the supporting of cinema. And I wish you all the best with getting further with all three projects. But, you know, it seems like you're a bit further on with the Home Invasion movie. And
This might be a time to also plug that It Cuts Deep will be available on Blu-ray and DVD on December 7th.
It will, and it's it comes out on general release at the end of this week. That is correct, isn't it?
All right, so world premiere at festivals end of this week. It's on Friday the 13th, which is very fitting.
It's very fitting indeed. So if you can, and that's in in the States, right?
Just in the States. And then if you follow Dark Sky Films and MPI Media, there will be updates, I assume, for when it'll hit different regions. And then hopefully sometime early 2021, it'll also hit streaming services as well.
Okay. Well, we recommend that everybody goes and checks that out. And it just leaves me to thank you, Nicholas, for coming on the show, and be sure to come on again anytime.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's been fun.
That was my guest, Nicholas, there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. And as always, I would like to thank you, listener, for tuning in to this latest episode of New Horror Express. Plus, remember, if you like what you heard, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. That's all for this time, but be sure to join us again next Monday when we will have another great guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya!